You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Paul.
Hi, Bob.
How are you doing?
Great. How are you?
I wouldn't go as far as you went. I'd say I'm fine. I'm okay. That was pretty extravagant.
I'm excited to be on the podcast.
Washington must have changed since I left. You're great. But that was a long time ago that I left. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of the Non-Zero Newsletter. This is a Non-Zero Podcast. I'm also, and this is kind of relevant to today's conversation, author of the recently published book, The God Test, Artificial Intelligence and Our Coming Cosmic Reckoning. You can read excerpts at thegodtest.net. And you are Paul Shari, the executive vice president at the Center for a New American Security. And you're author of a book that you and I discussed on the podcast a few years ago called Four Battlegrounds, Power in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. And you earlier had a book called Army of None, Autonomous Weapons and the Future of War. And you've also written very recently a piece in Foreign Affairs called Losing the War of the Future, How New Technologies Threaten America's Military Advantage, which is certainly topical because, as I'm sure you're aware, America is currently involved in a war in which a relatively small and less powerful nation militarily did better than some expected in the face of the combined might of America and Israel. And, you know, the Ukraine war is somewhat relevant there, too. A smaller, less powerful nation is held up better than some expected against a more powerful aggressor. So I wanted to talk about why that is and ultimately talk about what implications you think that has for the future of war. You know, of course, these two wars, Ukraine and Iran, are very different, different objectives on the part of the aggressors and so on. But there are some things that I think they have in common that are relevant to the, some would say, surprising success of the smaller nation. Is it possible to characterize, Paul, like, what that is, if I'm not wrong, if there indeed is some degree of overlap in the explanation?
No, I think there are some important lessons that we're seeing from both the U.S. conflict with Iran and the war in Ukraine. And I think what makes it compelling is exactly what you're describing, that these are very different kinds of conflicts. The Iran war, much more of an air and maritime and kind of missile and drone campaign. Ukraine, long, protracted ground conflict, looks a lot like World War I in many ways. And yet, we are seeing some common lessons about how technology is changing war. And one of those is really about the value of low-cost drones and missiles and the way that that enables countries to reach over the front lines, attack those in the rear, attack cities, air bases, inflict casualties, disrupt military operations. And the fact that the barrier to doing that is pretty low. In many cases, these are pretty low cost, pretty widely accessible technologies.
Mm-hmm. And we should probably say that as for Iran, the failure of air power alone to induce surrender is a pretty old story generically, right? Like there's, who is it, Robert Pape? Is that the scholar who's written so much about the failure of air wars? And so in that case, you might ask about the wisdom of the initial objective that some have. There was a hope that it would induce regime change. It didn't. And then you're kind of stuck even by, you know, the old rules, according to which air power was unlikely by itself to make a big difference. At the same time, Iran has done more than just survive, right? I mean, how would you, to just step back from the technology for a second, how would you describe the state of play in terms of what has been inflicted on kind of the American infrastructure of power in the region and how that may have have changed the dynamics even of regional politics. I know that's, you know, you're not like a regional specialist, but I'm just saying Iran has done more than survive, right? And this is relevant to the technology.
Well, it's directly relevant. And I think, look, politically, I think actually Iran has come out much stronger as a result, because in relative terms, they look much stronger relative to the United States than they did before the conflict. They have survived. They've weathered very punishing assaults from U.S. air power. They've continued to be able to disrupt transit through the Strait of Hormuz. You know, and so Iran looks much stronger than I think a lot of people would have thought had, you know, prior to this conflict. And they're coming out in a much stronger position where the U.S. is, you know, sort of forced to negotiate with them about reopening shipping. Doing it by force just hasn't worked for the United States.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, one thing I will probably come back to more than once in this conversation is asking you, like, to what extent is technology changing things in a really general and fundamental way, like offense versus defense balance? There may be no such change for all I know. But one thing we've seen in Iran is that even if you have, I guess, the world's most advanced anti-missile capability, it's not that easy to keep a country from doing a lot of damage with a combination of missiles and drones, right? I mean, it's hard. We still don't know. Well, for example, as we tape this, there was a very recent exchange, and I don't think we yet know how much damage Iran may have done to the bases in Jordan. But we now know that in the course of the war, quite a bit of damage has been done, right? And probably nobody is better equipped technologically to defend against missiles than the United States, I would think, right? So is there a really general lesson here about whether missiles can be defended against?
I think there is. I mean, I think there's like two sides to this war. One is the story of U.S. air power that's been very effective in blowing things up in Iran, but not forcing political change. As you said, that's not really surprising. I mean, that's been the true of air power for a very long time. What is surprising is Iran's ability to hit back without an air force that's able to be effective. Instead, using drones, using ballistic missiles, Iran has launched thousands of missiles and drones against U.S. and other bases in the region, against other Gulf countries, against Israel. And what's interesting is if you contrast this with, say, the kind of first-gen version of this that we saw in the Persian Gulf War in 91 with Saddam Hussein and Iraqi Scuds, the U.S. had sort of tried this when the Patriot had first started doing interceptions or first saw them. And famously at that time, while there was a lot of hype on TV, after the fact we found out Patriot was basically totally ineffective at intercepting Iraqi Scuds. Now, the missile interceptor game has stepped up significantly since then. And in fact, the U.S. and Israel have been very effective in intercepting ballistic missiles. But the volume of these missiles and drone attacks is so high, and it's so costly. The exchange ratio, the sort of cost of these interceptors and their limited number, that what we've seen is that it's just a really effective way for countries to go after adversaries and to cause very damaging attacks against U.S. air bases, destroying some very expensive aircraft on the ground. And it mirrors some things that we're seeing in other conflicts as well, like in Ukraine.
Yeah, and of course, one thing that's happened is since the Patriots were first developed, drones have become a thing. I mean, they were designed to counteract missiles initially. That's still what they're good at. That's still the one place where the kind of whatever they call the cost exchange ratio, the relative cost of the offensive weapon and the defensive weapon is not completely nuts, right? I mean, what is a Patriot cost, like, what, $6 million or something?
Four million.
And a drone, of course, is, we're talking orders of magnitude less. With a ballistic missile, it's another story. It doesn't seem quite so crazy to use Patriots to shoot those down. But I guess it's the addition of drones is what has left America seeming so relatively helpless, you might say. Has that been like a super decisive factor in this case?
Well, the most damaging attacks, and this is true both in Iranian attacks against regions and bases in the Middle East, but also what we're seeing Russia do against Ukraine, some of the most damaging attacks are with ballistic missiles. Mm-hmm. But what we've seen is that ballistic missiles and drones can be paired effectively together, sending waves of drones to saturate air defense systems, to draw out the interceptors and deplete them, and then ballistic missiles to come in, which are a more limited number, but against more high-value targets, can be precise. And so a lot of the really destructive attacks against U.S. air bases with ballistic missiles, but the drones are where the money, they really hit you in the wallet, because the mm-hmm. cost of these Iranian drones is like anywhere from $35,000 is one estimate for a Shahed drone, to on the low end, it seems as low as like $7,000. If you shoot that down with a $4 million missile, you're losing every time.
Yeah. And I guess the ballistic missiles, I mean, that covers a whole variety of things. And one thing that happens, I'm sure, is Iran, sometimes they're sending their older, less expensive missiles and less valuable to them missiles. But we're still using a Patriot shoot 'em down. And I understand now these rules may have changed as the Patriot supply has been reduced. But I gather we generally shoot two Patriots per incoming missile because they're not nearly perfectly accurate. And that puts your chances of hitting them over 50% collectively or something. Is that right?
Yeah, so like to get into some of the mechanics of this, I'm going to explain it, and then we'll take a step back. Like, why does all this matter? Why are we talking about all these numbers, right?
Yeah.
It's like you have what's called a probability of kill. So you might have a drone or an incoming ballistic missile, an interceptor, and you might say, what's the probability that I'm going to kill that incoming missile? And then to mm-hmm. get a high enough probability, you might have to say, well, I have to shoot two of them. And so that gets into something called shot doctrine, which would be, okay, with a certain threat incoming, how many interceptors am I going to use? And oh, by the way, you don't have that much time. So it might be I'm going to fire two and then see what happens, right? And I can't fire them even sequentially. I might have to fire like both at once. Or if you have a longer time horizon, you might shoot two and then wait, see if you got it, shoot again. This all sounds, let me just say, it sounds like a little bit like accounting, right? Like we're talking about the cost of these things and how many do you shoot and what's the probability and blah, blah, blah. And I guess the thing is like, yes, and it's kind of dry, but this is what we're seeing warfare shift to, is this war of attrition of low cost missiles and drones. And mm-hmm. what happened in the U.S.-Iran conflict, and this is true also between Ukraine and Russia, is it evolved to this sort of longer war of attrition of the U.S. mm-hmm. trying to chase down these mobile missile launchers and drone launchers and bomb those targets. Iran's still surviving and launching these attacks, and then the U.S. trying to find ways to intercept them. And in that kind of conflict, the math has got to work for you, right? And right now, it's not working for the United States. According to the mm-hmm. best estimates that I've seen, the U.S. has depleted, in just the war in Iran, about half of its inventory of THAAD, those are the high-altitude ballistic missile interceptors, missiles, and about two-thirds of its Patriot inventory from prior to the war. And that's just like, that's not positioning you to win this longer-term war of attrition. That is the reality of how we're seeing warfare evolve.
And in addition to being expensive, these things take us a while to produce. We just don't have the infrastructure to produce them very rapidly, right? So how many Patriots, I mean, we've used up hundreds and hundreds, and how many do we produce in a year? Like 100 or something?
Yeah, I don't know the exact number off the top of my head, but it's not nearly enough to get close. And mm-hmm. the Trump administration, to their credit, is ramping up production, but you have to expand production lines, and you're going to get funding from Congress, and that's going to take years to do. So it'll mm-hmm. take us several years just to replenish the inventory that we've depleted in the past couple months. Meanwhile, there's other threats around the globe, China, Russia, North Korea, that we've got to be ready for.
Okay. And one of your big messages is we have to shift the composition of our forces in favor of smaller, more numerous, cheaper arms. Is that right?
That's right. That's got to be part of the mix. That doesn't mean that you don't need submarines and aircraft carriers and stealth bombers. But the U.S. is, well, if you think about a, in some ways, what a military is trying to do, because you don't know what wars you're going to fight in the future or what your adversaries are going to, tactics they're going to use, or even who they're going to be for somebody like the United States. You're trying to have a portfolio approach, trying to invest in a bunch of different kinds of military capabilities to be ready for the future. And we are way overly weighted towards these very expensive, very exquisite platforms like stealth bombers and submarines and aircraft carriers and fighter jets. Or I should say, one caveat there was just, we're very heavily weighted on the fighter jet side, actually a little thin on the bomber side. And we don't have nearly enough of these low-cost systems, low-cost drones and missiles and missile interceptors, which is where we're seeing warfare going.
Yeah. The now, are there certain, you know, there are some weapons and weapon platforms that, you know, if you look at Ukraine and Iran together, have just seemed to be less valuable now than they were several decades ago. I'm thinking largely of tanks in Ukraine and aircraft carriers in the case of Iran. I mean, you know, for some time, it seems like the handwriting has been on the wall for aircraft carriers because more and more munitions that are delivered by air don't require like a human being to be, you know, riding in them or, you know, or even, you know, in a vehicle that deploys them. I mean, you know, notwithstanding the latest Tom Cruise movie, which I assume you saw, by the way, where, you know, humans are still front and center. And in fact, the moral of that story is the technology doesn't really matter. It's like how much heart the guy in the cockpit has. Is it the case that we're moving to a world where wars, either of these tanks or aircraft carriers, might in 10 or 20 years just kind of disappear from the picture as far as being effective things?
I think the shift we're seeing is, more roles for uncrewed systems, robotic system drones of various shapes and sizes. It's got to be a bigger part of the U.S. portfolio mix. So more aircraft that don't have people in them. That will lead toward a front line in the future that is less populated by humans. And we're seeing this to some extent already in Ukraine, where the front line of that war is largely depopulated. And in many cases, it's drones that are monitoring the front line that are used to surveil it, to detect troops that are trying to move, and then drones that are being used to attack them. The humans are still in the conflict, but they're further removed. And I think one way to think about this is it's part of a long trajectory in warfare of people using technology to find ways to reach out and hurt the other person while keeping yourself safe. From the first time somebody picked up a rock and threw it at somebody, to bows and arrows and intercontinental ballistic missiles. So I suspect that we'll end up in a place where there are tanks in the battlefield, but tanks are no longer the vanguard of maneuver. It's robots on the front line that are maneuvering, and the people are in armored vehicles a little bit further removed. Maybe they're a couple miles away, protected, sort of quarterbacking the fight. They're digitally connected. They're supervising what happened. They're directing the swarm, but the tank is no longer right out in front, making direct first-line contact with the enemy. They're more of a mopping-up role, which is actually similar to like how infantry often operate in, you know, maneuver warfare for the United States in armored formations, for example. By the time you get infantry hopping onto the back of a vehicle, you've already sent in heavier armored vehicles to kind of take over an area.
Now the lines in Ukraine have not been moving a whole lot, and that happens in wars. This wouldn't be the first time. Do you think that's to any extent a kind of basic consequence of drone warfare, where the lines are going to move a little less fluidly? Does that make any sense at all, or do you think it does?
I think the way in which these drones are being used today in the Ukraine war by both sides, both Russia and Ukraine, is certainly contributing to the stasis. And because what it's doing is it creates this sort of perpetual set of surveillance over the front lines and then some measure deep on both sides, some kilometers deep, where it makes it very hard to mass forces for an assault. If you're gonna if you're gonna assault and break through lines, you got to concentrate your forces there, which means before you get to the front line, you've got to mass them. And right now, because we have persistent surveillance using these drones, you can see that coming, and they can be attacked also from the air with drones or with artillery. And so it's actually just harder for either side to mass forces to conduct an assault now. Now, I think to what extent that that is true in future conflicts, you know, is maybe more of an open question, because there might be ways in which in future conflicts, drones could break that assault. Just like we saw in World War One, industrial age technology like the machine gun led to like a stasis on the trench lines of World War One. By World War Two, tanks and airplanes had broken that stalemate, and we saw a lot of maneuver warfare in World War II. I think that's more of an open question, but definitely drones are contributing to this stalemate today.
And has the defensive response to kind of the age of drones matured? I mean, you know, to get back to the whole idea of using like a Patriot to shoot down a drone, you know, what you would think just intuitively is needed is something more like an old-fashioned anti-aircraft gun on a World War II ship, except not manned by a human being. You know, presumably it would lock onto the target and fire automatically. Is a lot of that happening? I mean, are we just kind of waiting for the defense to catch up technologically with the age of drones, or what?
Yeah, I think there is some element of that where we're in the kind of like the early days and it takes a little while for the defense to catch up. Drones are vulnerable to a whole host of countermeasures. And sure, shooting down a $1,000 drone with a $1 million missile is not a great proposition, but they're vulnerable to anti-aircraft fire, the bullets. Like, I have a friend, as an aside, I have a sole buddy of mine in the Army, when I was at the Army, who shot down a drone in Iraq. Now, this was back in 2005. When the insurgents didn't have drones, it was one of ours. I pointed out to him, I said, hey, man, like, you know, they don't have them. That was one of our drones. He was like, oh, it doesn't matter. It counts. And I got a drone kill. But they're vulnerable to bullets. And there's lots of investment being made in ways to take out drones in simple ways, you know, using other drones, using nets, you know, fencing. There's been a lot of investment in the Ukraine war on sort of fencing and netting to protect ground vehicles, to protect troops, putting up in cities against some of these drones, to more exquisite countermeasures like high energy lasers and electromagnetic pulse weapons that could fry electronics. So I think some of that will catch up over time, you know, just like aircraft led to anti-air defense systems that go after aircraft. And then you see some of that balancing eventually.
Yeah. Now, just to make sure we're clear on this. So drones, a lot of these drones are not truly autonomous. Some of them, apparently in Ukraine, one thing that's done is to make them autonomous just for the last mile in case the enemy jams GPS or whatever. So in other words, for most of the journey, they're guided by, you know, a guy who's back, like with a joystick, I guess, he feels like he's playing a video game. These are the first-person viewer drones. And then at some point, they do have the thing lock on to a target. And at that point, it's truly autonomous so that if the GPS is jammed, it can still perform. But basically, even when it's a first-person viewer in FPV mode, it is functionally a lot like an autonomous weapon. I mean, the reason I ask is because it does seem to me we are getting a glimpse of a future where the battlefield is full of truly autonomous weapons, right? Because they will perform a lot like these FPV drones, in effect. Is that right?
Because they're maneuverable, you're saying, and they're kind of...
Well, because, you can see the target remotely and follow and keep an eye on the target and pursue the target. And that's what true autonomy will give you. I mean, when you see these kind of pathetic and harrowing videos of one of these quadcopters like chasing a guy who's running, you know? And I, to get back to what we just said, I always want to say, just stop and shoot it. Of course, it's easy for me to say, you know, I have assiduously avoided being on battlefields for my entire life. In other words, I assume that's often an FPV. There's an actual human being doing the chasing. But it's exactly what an autonomous quadcopter would do, right? Chase this guy wherever he goes is what I mean.
Yeah, I think that's true on one level, right? In fact, you could imagine that machines would be even better than humans at doing it, of maneuvering swiftly, although these FPV pilots are pretty impressive. I think the question is, like, when you get to the next step of, if you totally take out human decision-making, how does that change what's occurring on the battlefield? If it's not just the machines maneuvering the last mile to strike the target, but the machines are actually choosing the targets on their own, they're selecting those targets based on some pre-programmed set of criteria, some library they have, some machine learning that they've been trained on. There have been some isolated reports coming out of Ukraine of autonomous weapons being used on both sides, both by Ukraine and Russia. That would kind of go this next step where humans are still building them and launching them and kind of pointing them in a direction. But then the drone itself has sensors that allow it to detect targets that it then goes and attacks all on its own. And that feels like that does cross a pretty significant line in terms of the role of human decision making.
So you mean it's doing the initial target selection? It's not from the get-go. It is looking down and going, well, that looks like an enemy.
That's right. Now, again, based on some set of parameters, right? And so in one report, for example, there were a series of Russian drones that were used in an attack against Ukraine. And based on, to be fair, like caveat here, reporting from the Ukrainian military, they had claimed that these Russian drones did not have a communications link back to a controller, but they were using onboard computer chips and programming to identify propane tanks and gas station pumps. So fixed objects that the AI on board the drone would observe and detect and then swoop into attack, which is like totally doable with existing technology. Man, that technology dates back to probably 2012. It's almost 15 years old. So very, very possible.
And are there autonomous land-based weapons being deployed? It seems like I've seen examples. I doubt there's a lot of it, but I mean, are these trenches sometimes being approached by autonomous machines that can shoot?
We've had certainly some reports of both ground robots and fixed in place remote guns, like a remote sentry gun, but largely remote controlled. Now, one could imagine a remote sentry gun that was automatic, that would have an AI sensor and detect. But again, like, you know, a practical problem militaries would face would be that you don't want the machine gun wasting all of its ammo, shooting at, you know, leaves or squirrels or something else. But it's possible to envision AI systems that could be trained to detect people and then fire if someone was approaching, say, a trench line. We haven't seen any reporting of that being used yet in Ukraine, but I think it's certainly something that we will likely eventually see in conflicts to come.
And I assume people in the field you're in, some of the more futuristically oriented, talk about the possibility of a battlefield in the future that just has no real human beings on it, right? Like, at which point, I mean, a lot of questions arise as to the, you know, autonomous weapons, there are ethical criticisms I want to get into, but if it leads to a battlefield where there are no human beings, you can imagine virtues. I don't know. Anyway, is this a serious subject of discussion?
It's a serious subject of discussion. Now, I will lay my cards on the table and say, I don't think we're going to get there. And it's not because of the technology. I'm pretty bullish on the technology. I think that eventually we'll see robot swarms out on the battlefield fighting against other robot swarms. I think it's because humans will still be involved in two ways. One, that militaries, as a practical matter, need to have humans out near the front lines to coordinate and direct robotic systems, because it'll be easier to maintain short distance protected communications than longer distances. And so if you look at like drone operators in Ukraine, they're operating pretty close to the front lines, because it's much harder if they were operating from a further distance away. And so, you know, those communication links are vulnerable. They're a target for jamming, and militaries have ways to have protected, like jam-resistant communications, but it's better if you're closer. So I think that's one reason why we'll need people, militaries will still need people out there flying in jets, in bombers, being in tanks or ground vehicles or in submarines or something. But also, and this is a little bit darker, but I think this is real, is that wars probably won't end until there's a human cost. And so I think the future is probably not a one of like bloodless wars of robots fighting robots. It's probably one of humans killing other humans, unfortunately, but using robots in the future to do that instead of using missiles or bullets today.
Yeah. There was a Star Trek, in the first Star Trek TV series, where at the end, Captain Kirk is saying, "You've made war so neat and painless that there's no reason to end it." Although I think in that scenario, it was this thing where they fought the war by computer simulation, and whoever, and the computer would say like which soldiers had been killed, and those, and each side would have to have actual human beings killed in accordance with that output. But so that's a very different thing. It is, I guess. I mean, if you imagine pretty stable battle lines and no humans dying, I guess it would just be a question of who ran out of money first or something. So to get back to the Iran war, what should the U.S. have had in its inventory that would have led to better performance on the part of the U.S.? And again, the whole thing just may have been strategically misconceived from the get-go, you know. If regime change happens magically, exactly as you hope, fine. But what would you do after that, kind of in any event, right? But that said, if you just want to talk about objectives like making it harder to take out American assets in the region, the military bases in the Gulf states and so on, could you have said like a couple of years ago, well, here, you know, you need more of this and more of that? And what would it have been?
Yeah. Yeah. Let's acknowledge that the strategic aims of the war were certainly flawed from the beginning. And I think part of it was that the Trump administration had such remarkable success with the U.S. military mission to capture Venezuelan President Maduro and institute regime change in Venezuela, that they thought, oh, we'll just do something like that vis-a-vis Iran, right? We'll just decapitate the Iranian leadership and we'll get new people in charge and we'll kind of deal with them. Not realizing that, like, it's hardliners the whole way down in Iran. You can take off the top five levels of leadership and the people remaining, like, they're not going to surrender or cut a deal with the United States. Like, that's not how they're ideologically going to function. So, like, it was a flawed premise. Yeah, if you had to fight a war like this or be prepared for this kind of threat, I think there's some obvious near-term things. The U.S. should have much deeper strategic stockpiles of missile interceptors, of THAAD and Patriot missile interceptors. The U.S. needs lower-cost interceptors for drones. The U.S. is working to build those. The U.S. needs more munitions of its own, and that's been a longstanding concern about among U.S. defense analysts, that you've been jumping up and down for years saying that our munition stockpiles for interceptors and for offensive weapons that we'd use to attack Iran are too low in the event of a conflict. And the U.S. needs to get in the game on drones. Right now, the numbers here are kind of crazy. The Ukrainian military is cranking up 4 million drones a year, which is a lot of drones. The U.S. Army is buying 50,000 drones a year. And so, like, we're just playing a completely different game. And, you know, it's like other countries are in the majors and we're over here playing, like, Little League ball. And this is where warfare is evolving. Drones are going to be a part of it. We need to get in the drone game too.
Now, drones, do drones logically play a very large role in defense against drones? Or would that be more like what I was describing, like an automated machine gun, basically, if you wanted a cost-effective version of defense against drones?
I think the answer is kind of all of the above, depending on the size of the drone, where it's at. But certainly some of the drone interceptors look kind of like little mini kamikaze drones themselves that would be launched and would go after an incoming drone and take it out. And you need to make them low cost enough that that cost exchange ratio that we were talking about earlier works out at least relatively in your favor. It doesn't need to be cheaper than the incoming drone, but you need to be cheap enough that you're willing to buy a lot of these interceptors, that you have the wallet to kind of afford.
Okay. Now, I would have thought the Ukraine war has been going on long enough that I might have thought that Silicon Valley would have kind of swung into action in a way that you might like. I mean, of course, the backdrop is that historically you've had these very big defense, you know, arms makers, Lockheed and so on, and they build very big weapon systems. And in some ways, probably politics encourages that. And the making of the systems is divided up among the states and so on, which facilitates congressional support for them. So you had that whole history and just the history of war, where these had been the important weapons. But, you know, Silicon Valley has a reputation for being just kind of agile, responding to market forces. And it did seem to become evident several years ago in Ukraine that, the market, so to speak, for arms was increasingly going to demand smaller, more automated systems. And I'm wondering how much of that there's been. I did hear somewhere that this drone company that Eric Schmidt started, I've probably already gotten something wrong, but that has made some drones that actually have been effective in Ukraine. But I don't know whether those are small, cheap, big, clunky, or what. You do have these kind of new companies, I guess, like Anduril, which is a Silicon Valley arms maker founded by the guy who made, I guess, the Oculus, was previously in the virtual reality business. How much of that have you seen? How much adaptation has there been in the kinds of things that are being built in the United States?
There are a lot of new entrants into the defense space. You've got companies like Anduril, Shield AI, Eric Schmidt's got a drone company that are, some of them are more software oriented. Some of them are doing physical hardware, trying to build drones or drone interceptors. I think the biggest limiting factor right now has been government spending on the Pentagon side, which, like, you know, this is a place where there's a monopsony market. And so if the government isn't willing to spend the money, it doesn't matter how obvious the demand is to, like, you or me or anybody with, you know, two eyes, or how much even companies are willing to go there and build this stuff if the government's not willing to shell out the money in practice to get there. And that, I think, has been a big limiting factor. Again, if the Army's buying 50,000 drones a year, that's not a big enough signal in the market to really motivate those companies. You're going to get founders that are excited, and there has been a lot more money flowing in from the venture capital space into defense technology startups, but you've got to see some big winners. You got to see more companies like Palantir winning big, being new defense primes, in order for that to continue to pay off.
Now, does Palantir make any hardware?
No, they do the software kinds of focused things. So they're selling like systems to the military, rather than, you know, they're not necessarily like a drone manufacturing. They're, you know, one of these companies that's been able to come in from Silicon Valley, kind of fight their way in a tough way and make inroads into the defense space. And now they're, you know, a new prime effectively in the defense space. But I think in order to continue to see that level of excitement from Silicon Valley and from the venture community that are going to invest in these startups, you've got to see more companies like that actually make it through to the other side of this struggle with, you know, what's sometimes called in the defense space, the Valley of Death. That basically the Pentagon will fund like small R&D projects, and there's some cool DARPA thing. And then you go, okay, we're going to field that at scale to the Navy or the Air Force, the Army, or the Marines. And then it's like you got to cross this valley of death that very few make it across to get to that point of scale.
Yeah. And it hasn't mattered much that in the case of the Ukraine war, I gather that in a sense, the customer is now Europe, right? I mean, Europe is paying for the weapons that are going to Ukraine, but that hasn't changed anything?
Most of the drones are being made domestically inside Ukraine. And when I was in Ukraine and I spoke with the head of, their folks on this, both drone manufacturers, drone pilots, people in their armed forces, and I asked them about this, they said that they had by and large seen, and I don't want to paint too broad of a brush here because I'm sure there are some U.S. drone companies would say, oh, we're, you know, our stuff's in Ukraine, it's doing well. But by and large, they were pretty dismissive of American-made drones. And I said, well, why? Mm. What's the limitation here? They said, well, they're over-engineered. They're not effective on a battlefield. And I said, well, what's the disconnect? Why are they not working? And they said the biggest thing was time cycles, that they were in Ukraine adapting to what's happening on the front lines in real time. And I saw this. I talked to drone manufacturers, visited their factories, their plants, where they were in chats on a daily basis with Ukrainian military units who were giving them feedback on performance on the front lines, and they were changing the drones that were made in production that same day. Mm-hmm. And contrast that with, they were saying American companies would get through some complicated procurement, you know, sort of release process over here in the United States, be able to export their drone, get it to the battlefield, get some feedback on it, take it back, and then there's 12 months of like testing and re-engineering and fightering their way through our export control process to be able to get it back over to Ukraine. And they're like, yeah, it's just not, it's too slow to be effective.
Yeah. So on the whole ethics of autonomous weapons thing, and you know, and I should kind of put my cards on the table too. I wonder whether this issue, I do think there are cases where some important ethical issues are raised and cases where autonomy is used to kind of conceal some ugly truths about target selection and so on. But at the same time, you know, for me, sometimes it's just like a red herring. Like there was this whole standoff between Dario Amodei, head of Anthropic, and the Pentagon, and he wanted, first of all, he's not against autonomous weapons if they work reliably. He did say when it comes to target selection, he would always, he wants a human in the loop. And, you know, it seems to me it's pretty easy to put a human in the loop in a kind of pro forma, not super consequential way. You know, the guy glances at the list and says, yeah, those look like targets, let's do it. Whereas, for me, the bigger issue with Iran, and for that matter, Venezuela, is that they are plainly illegal wars in the sense of violating the UN Charter. They were it was unprovoked aggression, a very clear-cut case. The U.S. Constitution, you know, the UN Charter is a treaty. U.S. Constitution says that ratified treaties become the law of the land. And, of course, the Constitution also raises questions about the legality of a war not authorized by Congress. So I'm kind of thinking that if Dario Amodei really wants to take a stand, he might just say, I don't want our technology used in wars that aren't clearly in compliance with national and international law. He explicitly did not do that. I mean, I don't know if you saw, did you see the interview where the woman kind of pressed him more than people generally press him? I think she was from Bloomberg, about the role that Claude had played in target selection. Claude was to some extent integrated with Maven, the software run by Palantir Target Selection. It selected the initial list of targets. She brought up the bombing of the girls' school, which was, of course, an accident, but it was on the target list. And he didn't try to distance Anthropic from it. I thought he might say, well, Claude's role was actually this or that. He didn't seem to deny that that Claude had probably played a role. He just said kind of, you know, accidents happen in war. It's terrible. And he explicitly said the overall war was within our use case. That part's fine. Anyway, that's a long-winded way of explaining where I stand on this, which is we shouldn't fight illegal wars. And I honestly, I guess the autonomous, the kind of strongest ethical issue, you know, case I've seen made against them was made in Israeli magazine 972, mm-hmm. having to do with the automated target selection in using Gaza. And I think their argument was, look, the actual rule is basically kill all young males, whether they're armed or not. And it's easy to avoid admitting that if there's this mysterious target selection software. So I don't want to say there aren't any good ethical dilemma, you know, any good ethical questions being raised. But honestly, on balance, it doesn't seem to me that autonomous weapons are the problem. Or to shift, or that they kill any more by and large innocent people than human orchestrated weapons. I mean, that target list in Iran was, I think, originally assembled by humans. Right now, you might know more than I, and you can correct me. But I might have said, look, if you're going to use a large language model, one of its missions should be to really critically scrutinize every single target. That's something an LLM should be good at. And if there's any good question you can raise about the validity of a target, do it. But my assumption is that the initial target list that Claude may have reviewed or something was assembled by humans. But maybe you know more than I do. I guess to the extent that there's a question buried in that. Soliloquy, it's how big an issue are autonomous weapons really? I mean, you know, you're familiar with World War I and World War II. Like, the problem wasn't autonomous weapons, right? So you take my point, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, I think it depends a little bit on your point of view. I think coming to, like, what you were talking about were some of your objections to these conflicts, which is to say that you know, one point of view is that, like, the problem is war. And sometimes the objections I'll hear about autonomous mm-hmm. weapons, I'll hear them and I'll think, well, it seems like what you're actually objection to is war, which is mm-hmm. like totally valid, right? War is horrible. Like that is a valid concern. I think the more specific question than with autonomous weapons is like, well, what is specifically different or worse about autonomous weapons versus some other alternative, right? Because presumably, like, it's not like we haven't had autonomous weapons, so it's not like we haven't had wars. We've been still having wars. So what's going to change if we end up with autonomous weapons? And one point of view might be nothing really changes that much. Another point of view might be actually autonomous weapons would make warfare better in various ways, right? Maybe we were talking earlier about these sort of, you know, wars of robots fighting robots and there's no humans involved. Maybe I'm wrong. And like, that's the future. And the robots go fight each other and leave us out of it. And then we kind of see which robots are, you know, remaining at the end. And then we go, okay, like, I guess somebody won, you know, you won, you lost. And like, we'll move on. I think what makes me skeptical of that, I'll say, was as a little bit of an aside here, there's like an interesting cautionary tale from the Gatling gun. Which was the early forerunner of the machine gun. It was invented by Richard Gatling, an inventor during the Industrial Revolution. And he saw all these men coming back from the Civil War with these grievous injuries, the American Civil War. And he thought, well, what if I could make an invention that would allow one soldier to do the work of, you know, like 100 soldiers, and then we could reduce the number of troops on the front lines and save mm-hmm. lives. His intent was to save lives. And what we saw was the opposite happened, that in fact, that when machine guns were introduced in warfare, we got these horrific, horrific battlefields in World War I, where like whole generations of young men in Europe were killed in the trenches of World War I because the lethality of warfare had gone up considerably.
Right.
So I think like one of the open questions, what's hard about this question of autonomous weapons is like, what is the effect of introducing autonomous weapons into the battlefield? Does it make things like warfare more precise, more humane, lower civilian casualties? Does it look like what we expect will happen when we see self-driving cars finally take over roadways, reduce traffic fatalities. That would be amazing for self-driving cars. Like, could something like that happen in warfare? Or does it make it far worse? Does it make warfare far more deadly to combatants, to civilians? Does it lead to this moral offloading of responsibility, mm-hmm. like was alleged in the 972 report about what Israel was alleged to have been doing using AI? And I think it's actually like kind of hard to know. We can look at historical examples and make some educated guesses, but we don't know. And that drives a lot of the debate about autonomous weapons, these kind of assumptions about what might happen when they're introduced to war.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I want to talk some more about this, the ethics of autonomous weapons. I also would like to, if you'll indulge me, inquire a little into your own battlefield experience, because you were in the service, and I think you served in Iraq. And did you also Afghanistan or not?
That's right. Yeah, both Afghanistan.
So we're going to do that. As you know, Paul, we with this podcast, we generally do a little more than half of it for the general public, and then we spend some time in overtime, which our Non-Zero's paid subscribers have access to. I encourage people to become one. There's a link in the show notes. You can go to nonzero.org and just click on this post, and you'll see, you know, the both the unpaid and the paid version, and a way to get to the latter. Before we go into overtime, I just wanted to give you a chance to say anything else on the subject you want to say, including, first of all, any information about where people can find anything of yours you want them to find, what your Twitter handle is, anything like that. But also, if you think we didn't get enough into what your advice is for the future of American weapons acquisition, feel free to say a little more about that.
Sure. Yeah. I guess just in terms of the info, yeah, sure. I'm on Twitter and LinkedIn. Folks can find me there. They can check out my website, paulshori.com. My book, Books for Battlegrounds and Army of None. You can find information about the Center for a New American Security at cnas.org online. So those are kind of like the details to find all those things. I guess maybe one just parting thought, which is, you know, it's a lot of the changes we're talking about are being driven by militaries, by defense companies, but we all have a stake in this future. And so mm-hmm. I think it is excellent that these debates are happening in the open publicly about what is the role that AI is going to play in warfare, what, if any, rules domestically, internationally, should govern this technology? You know, should we have autonomous weapons? What, if anything, should be done about them? Should be any guardrails around them? Because we're all going to live in this future, and we need to make sure that we're using this technology in a way that benefits people. And there's a lot mm-hmm. of debates that are happening domestically about AI, about data centers, about AI and jobs. And I would just say that there are, you know, sort of similar analogous debates, different issues, but similar deep, deep questions about the role of AI in conflict and in warfare that are really essential to get right. And the stakes are quite literally life and death. And we all have a stake in what that is. So I encourage people to, you know, get involved, read more about this, weigh in various ways, and, you know, let your voice be heard as well.
Okay. Well, thank you. And with that, we will now head into overtime.